Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Begin this morning with Peter Hooper. He is the chief economist at Deutsche Bank, and he's with us here in our Bloomberg 1130 studios. Let's travel to Western Portugal, if we could, here to begin, Peter, and to the goings on there over these last couple of days. We watched with interest as Mario Draghi spoke about the employment picture in Europe, about the inflation picture as well, and saw him and the ECB try to walk back some of what he said. A great lead on a Bloomberg news piece this morning. This is what it sounds like when doves screech. What happened? What do we learn about the way that central bankers communicate here over these last couple of days?
Well, central bankers obviously have big impacts on the market, and Mr. Draghi had to correct perceptions a little bit yesterday, people getting a little – interpreting him as being a little bit more hawkish than I think he wanted to be. Says, no, we're going to take our time and moving towards balance sheet normalization, this sort of thing. But certainly, I think that the sense that my colleague George Saravalos has come up with something very unusual. I mean, central banks don't normally coordinate on policy. Mm-hmm. I mean, at most you have some moving in concert because the data are moving together across countries, and they happen to be moving in the same direction. But the sense that Mr. Draghi, I guess, introduced the word coordination in his text. We wonder if we're going to get a little pushback on that as well now from him or from some of his colleagues. But it's an interesting possibility. I think certainly the data have been suggesting there's room for that.
Two sets of headlines coming out now as we interrupt Dr. Hooper of Deutsche Bank. This in the corporate world. David, I don't know if you've got these up on your screen. David has a faster boom. What is it? Why does David Gura have a better
computer? A few dollars a month
than I do. Does he pay more? You know, my computer's like the original one Mike made years ago. Sky TV. Is this going to happen? Sky shares erase gains.
Yeah.
On looks, United looks like, King inclination.
Yes. The UK government inclined to refer the Fox Sky bid to regulator. We were expecting some word on that this morning. Indeed, we did get that. And then some news here about Rite Aid and Walgreens Boots as well. They're mutually agreeing to terminate their merger. This has been something they've been undulating, churning here for many months.
A sizable deal, $5 billion.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're going to do it. Walgreens, rather, is going to authorize a $5 billion share buyback program out of this. Walgreens will pay, this is the kind of fee Peter Hooper would pay someone, $325 million termination fee. Wow.
Yeah. Walgreens buying stores and assets from Rite Aid for $5.18 billion in cash. So a couple stories we'll be following throughout the morning
here
on Bloomberg Surveillance. Yeah. We won't make Dr. Hooper comment on that.
Why don't you continue here with David, it's almost schizophrenic. Is that the right word?
Well, yeah.
You know, the action of bankers.
Yeah, exactly.
The last few days.
Let me ask you here sort of what we heard, you know, talking about the influence of Mr. Draghi's speech a couple of days ago back in Sintra. He talked about the employment picture, the challenges facing European employment, how that dovetails with inflation. What did you make of what he had to say there? In other words, there seemed to be some positive indications about sentiment in the Eurozone, positive indications about where the employment picture is headed, but he still seems not satisfied.
Well, I think the main reason you're not satisfied is inflation has been a little on the soft side of late, and that's the key. That is ultimately the ECB's objective, and the employment picture obviously feeds into that, and growth is important. Growth has been doing pretty well, and the prospects there for continued advancement in the 1.5-2% range over the year ahead seems reasonably good, and the labor market likely picking up with that. I think the interesting point is that he's suggesting that the softness of inflation that normally would keep a central bank like the ECB very much at bay is viewed as being transitory, which is the same kind of message you're getting out of the Fed. I think these central banks generally are feeling we've been at these emergency floor levels for quite a while. There is a little bit of growing concern on this side of the Atlantic about financial stability issues maybe associated with that. So I think it's a little bit of a mixed message out of Europe, but overall, this is a central bank that we think will be tapering further around the end of this year and progressing with at a much slower pace, lagged long behind the Fed, but is moving in that direction.
Let me ask you about that descriptor, transitory, something that we heard from Chair Yellen after that rate decision during her press conference. She said it many times. It was certainly in the statement as well. Do you agree with her on that point? How hard is it for her to defend the transitory nature of the inflationary headwinds we're seeing here in the U.S.?
Well, the recent surprises of inflation, what's been driving that? In March, we had this huge drop in cell phone service charges with the BLS. I think probably struggling a little bit to catch up on some quality changes there, and maybe there was an unusually large observation. Since then, we've seen certainly in the CPI a significant decline in doctors' fees, for example. Medical healthcare inflation has come down after rising pretty strongly. So you have this sort of a natural correction, a slowdown from a very large increase previously. I don't see pressures on healthcare inflation diminishing with the baby boom generation continuing to age. I think that overall is going to be a slow uptrend there. Other areas, we had a drop in apparel inflation. Goods inflation surprised a little bit to the downside. Apparel inflation had again risen well above where the producer prices had been running. They're catching up now, and finally a little bit of a slowdown in the rental inflation, housing inflation, if you will. That is not a trend that we expect to continue either, because vacancy rates are low. So all of these factors say transitory.
Peter Hooper, thank you so much. Very generous of your time. And again, thank you to your colleague, George Saravalos, for joining us in London earlier this morning. Dr. Hooper is with Deutsche Bank. Joining us now, Doug Kass. Doug, I'm in therapy. No other way to put it. It's fun to watch the Yankees. Have you had more fun watching your dreaded New York Yankees in years?
The greatest, the most fun I think I've had probably in 10 years. You know, and you saw it developing. You saw a bunch of young players being developed. And even Jim Palmer in our interview on surveillance a couple months ago was bullish on the Yankees and bearish on the Orioles.
Within this,
but last night was exciting, and I sent you an email. You noticed the standings as we have this interview. Winning percentage 0.553 New York.
Always
Yankees.
Providing good notes to us here, Tom.
Red Sox, 0.551.
Why you keep your finger over the red button? That would be the exit cast button. Anyways, folks, for our global audience, this is exciting. And just one more comment on the baseball thing, Doug. I sat last year in the Doug Cass seats right by Joe Girardi to the left of the dugout, and there was this big lummox out on the on deck circle. And you have I seen this? Rookie baseball players need time to lose the panic of OMG, I'm here. And that's what we saw with Aaron Judge from this year to last year, last year to this year. And now you got this whole youth, this kiddie core coming up. I mean, it's amazing.
And Aaron Judge, I mean, 27 caters. And it's a remarkable performance.
You've been wrong, Doug. The bull market continues. When does this end? Last Friday, all the gloom. And you're not writing gloom crew emails. Describe the nuance of your caution on this bull market versus the usual doom and gloom stuff we all read.
Well, I think the issue to me is not how high the S&P is this morning. The issue to me is how long the markets will stay this high. And I think to understand what's happened, what's happening today, we have to understand what's happened in history. And the fact is that very few active managers were able to deliver alpha over the last decade or so. And you saw it, they were not protected in the large drawdown in 2007-9, for example. And the public looks at these outcomes and says, why the heck should I pay higher fees to managers who can't outperform or can't identify a speculative blow-off or an imminent drawdown of major magnitude? Let me just stay fully invested. I might as well be in an ETF or an index fund. So since 2007, the Great Recession, basically passive activities and indexing has risen from about 8% to almost 40%. And as you shift assets from active managers to passive managers, they buy an index. Since the index is capital weighted, it means more and more money is going into fewer and fewer stocks. And we've seen this before, and so have you guys. We saw it when I entered, when I graduated business school in the early 70s with the Nifty 50 stocks.
Yeah.
You outperformed only if you continued to go into them. If you were a growth stock manager in the late 1990s, you were, if you weren't buying the net stocks, you underperformed, you were fired. More and more money went into fewer and fewer stocks. The NASDAQ ultimately declined by 82%. So you have a similar case today with the FANG stocks. More and more money is being deployed into a narrower and narrower area. In each case, this trend doesn't end well.
Doug, let me ask you about the deal that we saw scuttled this morning between Walgreens and Rite Aid. What's your takeaway from what happened there? Does it shed any insight into for you into the regulatory landscape? Does it say something just specifically about the sense of this deal in and of itself? What's your take on what we saw this morning?
Well, I would say not with regard to that deal, David, individually, but I do think that the political and regulatory landscape is moving unfriendly towards the market leaders, the FANGs, owing to obviously a market dominance. And you look at, say, an Amazon. The question is to me, and I've written on the street about this over the last month since the Whole Foods deal was announced. The question to me is, Amazon a company that's providing lower product prices to the consumers, or is it creating jobs and the destroyer of our economy? And I think you're going to hear a lot about this going forward.
Within all this is use of cash, which is a fundamental concept. And I might point out to those younger that Mr. Cass has a little bit of experience in securities analysis. We're seeing it with a vengeance in the banks. Do you have the courage to short the banks here, Doug?
Actually, I just shorted this morning in pre-market trading Bank of America, Citibank, and J.P. Morgan.
Why?
On the ramp, and it's simply a trade. Look, I think I followed the industry since I was a Nader Raider and wrote a book called Citibank with Ralph Nader and while I was finishing my MBA at Wharton. This is an industry that has deleveraged and has a low return on assets and is barely earning its cost of capital. Its valuations have risen dramatically, and the industry faces three dominant headwinds: lower credit demands going forward, a flattening yield curve, and low absolute interest rates. And this could potentially be a toxic cocktail while the market is rejoicing this morning.
Well, I have a toxic cocktail with Fortress Moynihan. Good morning, Mr. Moynihan. I know you're listening. Operating income at BAC has gone 24, 26, 27, and somebody's modeling out for next year $32 billion large. I mean, as a growth vector, maybe it's not a diamond growth vector, but it's a Moynihan growth vector. How do you short that growth vector in operating income?
That's a little bit of data mining, because you have to go back and see what the disaster was the 5 years prior to that.
And you think we're going to revisit that disaster?
I don't think we're going to revisit it. I think the stocks are more than fully priced relative to their projected returns on equity.
Let me ask you, we were talking about regulation here just a moment ago. We're going to talk about stress tests a little later on the program. But what is what we've seen here over these last 2 weeks, these two rounds of stress tests, tell you about the health of the financial sector here in the U.S.?
The financial sector is relatively strong, especially vis-a-vis the pre-Great Recession crisis in 2007-09. But so is the industry's earnings power. It's much lower.
Yeah. Doug, fold in here what Sherry Yellen's doing in central bank. You do that. It's not just all equity analysis for Mr. Cass. We've had a real shift in the last 2 days, and really for the first time since I can remember, it almost looks like a coordinated hope and prayer by bankers that inflation or disinflation will migrate into some form of greater inflation. Do you agree with the coordinated action of banks in their discourse and rhetoric, or does that end up being market volatility?
I think that they're going to coordinate in terms of tightening. And what I really don't understand is the market's ebullience. I understand the ebullience following a period of historically large monetary largesse. I don't understand, I don't envision a positive response in the fullness of time from tightening. It just doesn't follow. I thought you were getting at something, Yellen's quote on Tuesday.
Oh, yeah, no more financial crises.
Yeah. I mean, it's remarkable. I did a piece entitled Some Really Stupid Things Uttered by Some Really Smart People on the Street a day ago. And it's kind of a humble reminder, David and Tom, of how dim our visions are. We talk about the market's ebullience right now. The fact is many sectors have gone down. No. Many shorts have been quite successful in 2017. And we live because of the dominance of passive investing and quant strategies in a market without memory from day to day.
Well, let's come back with memory and talk to Doug Cass of Seabreeze Partners. Lots to talk about. I think we should do a little more maybe investing 101, which is in a log normal world, how not to lose money, which may be of sport. With us on investment wisdom on how not to lose money, Douglas Cass, Seabreeze Partners. Doug, there's a guy named Ven Tharp who wrote a really important book, and in it, a jewel of a chapter years ago on what he called position sizing. I call it in my lectures the how muchedness, which is something nobody ever talks about, which is you decide to do this long, this short, and the real art is how much do you put into the trade? If you've been short and you've been in a long bull market, how do you not get wiped out? How does Doug Cass do the how muchedness when you commit to a trade?
Great question. One of the things, first of all, position size is a function of your time frames and also of your risk appetite or risk profile. I personally am a very conservative short seller. So I take relatively small positions, particularly against my core investment long positions. As well, I do a lot of synthetic puts. I short stocks and buy out-of-the-money calls. So what does that do for me? That basically allows me to quantify the risk I have, not only in each individual short, but in my entire portfolio. Essentially, I'm paying for the privilege of protecting the short position. And that worked out, obviously, very well for me in 87 and 2007 to 2009. And I suspect when the markets finally do break, as they always have historically, it will work out going forward.
Doug, how much is the price of oil right now shaping your investment outlook?
Well, something that no one really is talking about, I'm of the view that not only stocks are overpriced, but so are bonds. And I believe that the 10-year is based upon my calculus, is projecting a sub 1% real growth in the domestic product domestically, and that's too low. And the recent decline in the price of oil, going, as Dennis Gartman, our friend, says, from the top of the left chart to the bottom right, is historically, at least that's what I learned at business school and used to work in the 70s and 80s and 90s until quant trading strategies took over. That's a stimulant to growth.
When you mentioned Whole Foods a little while back, I want to ask you about that deal in particular. What it says about the direction of retail. When that news broke, Tom and I were scrambling just to figure out sort of what directionally that means.
When Doug has breakfast at Mar-a-Lago,
I forgot about that.
The avocado omelet. You know, he wants a gluten-free Whole Foods avocado omelet.
Yeah,
that's the way it is. Yeah.
I actually had dinner when the president of China was there.
You were there.
Yeah.
Did you conduct foreign policy with everyone else?
I was there for the briefing.
I was with a high-level I do have Republican friends.
Jesus.
I was with a high-level Republican.
Surveillance break exclusive right there. But, Doug, what does that say to you about the direction?
Kramer doesn't know that.
No. Direction of retail. What does the Whole Foods Amazon deal say to you?
Well, the disruption continues.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would question and suggest we are approaching peak Amazon and peak Fang for the reasons I mentioned, as well as, you know, the growing political and regulatory risk that these companies face. Look at the advertising market for a second. Facebook and Google have approximately 80% of online ad dollars going to them.
Mm-hmm.
Online advertising accounts for roughly 25% of total advertising today. So multiply 0.8 times 25%.
Very good.
And that means they have roughly, those two companies have 20% of total advertising in this country. And that's probably in the process of peaking. No one's talking about that much.
Doug, one final question, if we could. When do you cover a short? If we get to Dow 22,000, do you change your view? I mean, how do you flip to being a bull?
Well, I'm not flipping to being a bull. You know, I am concerned increasingly about sector risks. I'm concerned about a higher percentage, as I mentioned, of assets in index funds. And I'm worried that both quant strategies mm-hmm. and passive investing, which has been a stabilizing influence and a tailwind for the equity markets, will become destabilizing influences because fear ultimately will enter the marketplace.
Okay.
We probably don't know what the specific catalyst. Yeah. And all you have to do is ask two words at that point. To whom are index funds and ETFs going to sell to? They don't carry any cash reserves. And active managers who have diminished in size, most of them aren't carrying high levels of liquidity for fear of business.
The last marginal.
So I think we're witnessing the development of potentially a perfect storm.
Okay. A perfect storm. Yes, that defines the New York Yankees. Doug Kass, thank you so much. This is Bloomberg. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. We love to get in guests when they're wrong, beat them up, make them clear that we keep score at Bloomberg Surveillance. But every once in a while, we're afforded the luxury of a victory lap. Charles Peabody is one of the deans of bank analysis on the street, and you need a major victory lap, Charles. A year and a half ago, Charles Peabody said, not now, but a year and a half from now, the cast spigot will turn on. That's what we're observing in the last 48 hours, right?
Definitely. And I was even more conservative than most street analysts on the CCAR capital return requests. So it beat all expectations.
Within this is the durability. Doug Kass was just on with us, cautious on the banks for a set of good reasons. You would push against that, I believe, and say they're cash machines. Are they their own internal ATM machine?
From a capital perspective, they do have excess capital, and that was born
out. What about on the income statement?
But on the P&L, you have to sort of split the regionals and the money center banks and the brokers. I think you're going to see very weak second quarter earnings out of the brokers and money center banks because the capital markets have not been very robust. And that's going to lead to a lot of estimate cuts And I think more to come in the second half of the year.
Okay, importantly here, Mr. Peabody nudging towards the world of Doug Cass, which is a scary thing to say. Can Jamie Dimon keep double-digit dividend growth going, 13% five-year dividend growth? Is it a single-digit world for Mr. Dimon?
I think it is a single digit on the dividend for him. He's pushing up against that soft cap of a 30% payout ratio of earnings. So now to raise the dividend is a function of your earnings power, and it's tough to grow earnings double digits.
Well, particularly here with the nominal GDP, we just said, what's your single best buy? We're going to come back and talk to you more about banking, but do you have a single best buy right now?
Well, you know, I don't have buy-rated stocks at the moment just because of the weak earnings outlook. But there's no question that Citigroup hit the ball out of the park in this capital.
Good. Let's do that. We don't talk enough about Mr. Corbett. Let's do that. Let's come back with Charles Peabody and talk about Fortress. I don't say that, David.
No, you don't.
I saw him at Davos. You know, I got the banker wave. The banker wave, David, is when the bankers see me from 42 feet away.
And duck the other way.
They wave. The other way. Yeah. You know, like they got four handlers around him. No, don't talk to him.
Yeah.
I got the Corbett
you stand
banker
out,
wave.
You're easy to spot. So
you know, it's a banker wave. Yeah. It happens way. Larry Fink doesn't give me the banker wave. He'll actually come and talk to me.
I get that same wave a lot.
You get the banker wave. The banker. Hi, Joey Evangelista once crushed Jamie Dimon's elbow. Squeeze. Don't talk to him. Don't talk to him. Joe, that hurts. Anyways, it's fun. The banker wave. Yeah, we'll come back with Charles Peabody. Truly excellent on the major in the regional banks and get some wisdom and perspective.
David Gura and Tom Keene here in New York in our Bloomberg 1130 studios with Charles Peabody. Great to have you with us here talking about the banks. Let me start just by asking you broadly about these stress tests. We've just been through them. At this point, now a few years into them, how much have they improved? How much are they telling you about the health of the banking sector?
Oh, dramatically improvement. I mean, the amount of capital that they returned in this exam was way beyond anyone's expectations, and they still have excess capital. So, you know, returning 100% of your net income is probably going to continue going forward.
How much do they stand to change here as you survey, if you look ahead here to what the regulatory landscape could look like 6 months, a year out? Are we going to see a different kind of test going forward?
Well, you know, one could argue that this test showed some leniency from the regulatory community, and that may continue under Trump. But I caution about getting too far ahead of yourself on that front, because I think financial legislative reform is probably dead in the water until, you know, health care and tax reform and we get through the midterm elections. So it's not going to happen until 19 at the earliest. If you look at regulatory fiat reform, that's the way it's going to occur. But even there, the process is you got to get the nominees in place. You're not going to get confirmation hearings probably until early 18. And then you've got, you know, a notice of proposed rulemaking, the hearing period. You're probably not going to get formal rules changed until early 2019 on the regulatory fiat front.
Where are we with the regionals? We have a huge wrong bias here to six or seven big banks. Where are we on the regionals right now? Do they have a place in the future of banking?
Well, you know, at Compass Point, the position is very constructive on the regional banks. Now, they are, you know, they're going to benefit from the steepening yield curve and from, you know, the rate hikes if that continues. The problem is the loan growth remains fairly anemic at 3%. And that's the problem I'm having with banks in general, is I'm just not seeing the economic activity either in the lending markets or the capital markets. And so, you know, there's only so much cost cutting you can do. And we're probably on the other side of the credit spectrum where credit costs now are going to rise. So you need much more stronger revenue growth.
Oh, okay, that's right where I wanted to go. And then I want to go to Citigroup. Then are we going to see nominal GDP or better revenue growth, or is it going to be we must merge and combine because we don't have 5 or 6 or 7% revenue growth?
I think in the muddle through economy that we seem to be having, a 1.5-2% right. GDP growth, you're going to see much more of a combination of firms take place at the regional bank level.
How is Mr. Corbett's challenge different from Mr. Moynihan's or Mr. Dimon's?
Well, he's transformed the bank from what was really a consumer-led orientation to much more of a corporate-led orientation. As you know, Corbett and Fries both came out of Salomon Brothers, and that's where they're more comfortable taking their risk. So the challenge is, can they improve their capital markets positions, particularly on the equity side?
Do they have a desire to do that, or are they so far behind they can't catch up?
No, they have a very strong desire to do that. I mean, they've got an excellent FIC franchise, fixed income currency franchise, but they're a weak sister on the equity side, and they've been pushing pretty aggressively on the equity side to up their position.
How do they do that? Do they do it with a global projection? Do they do it with marketing and branding? Do they do it by retaining? Do we get into a body war, which no one's expecting?
The body war that I'm seeing is that they're being much more aggressive in the bidding. For example, on the equity front...
What do you mean by bidding? Bidding for what?
Deals.
For deals.
For example, on the equity side right now, we're seeing a lot of equity issuance through what we call block overnight deals, where you buy the deal at 4 p.m. and you try and sell it out before
it's called Blue Apron is what we call it. That's a joke, folks. Not going well this week. I believe Goldman's lead.
The menu has been set in the dinner tables.
Yeah,
right?
Mr. Corbett eats only at Seamless. Yeah.
And we saw this happen in 14 and early 15, and then all of a sudden the markets fell in the second half of 15, and Citi got hurt in the fourth quarter because they were trying to do that. So it's a question of managing the risks. They have managed them well so far.
I mean, there's a guy overlooking all this who's pretty important, a guy named O'Neill out of Hawaii. How's Michael O'Neill done in giving Corbett the chairmanship guidance to reframe the disaster that it was?
I think they've set out a very constructive strategic plan, and Corbett has been executing on that. It's taken longer than I think anyone anticipated.
Do they need retail?
They need cards, and that's the big growth story for the second half of the year, is that we're going to see the card business.
Am I going to get a $100,000 Visa, 100,000-mile Visa card out of Citigroup? That's all I want to know. I mean, that's what it's come down to, right?
Listen, by their own admission, they had underinvested in that card business, and about 2 years ago, they started really pushing that card business. And now we're starting to see a payoff in the second half of the year. But it's coming at a time where there's an inflection in the credit costs, and all these banks are having to raise their assumptions of credit costs. The question is, how rapidly do they rise versus
where David Gura lives? There's six branches on the corner. It's called overbanking. Are they Citigroup overbanked? Are they overbranched?
Citigroup does not have the branch structure that a B of A or J.P. Morgan has in the United States. In New York City and in certain pockets, they do, and that's their strategy, is to target urban areas.
We were talking about blockchain and Bitcoin and cryptocurrency a little earlier on the program. When you look at all of the banks, who's best positioned to embrace technological change in the industry?
Well, I think J.P. Morgan and Jamie Dimon have been years ahead of the other major banks in investing in technology. So I would say that they probably have the advantage. But everyone's investing in digital technology right now, and they're all going to end up in the same place.
How big a weight are student loans? We were talking about delinquencies on the show yesterday, the prospect for more of them in auto loans and in student loans. When you look at the big banks, how much of a weight is that on them?
It's a non-issue.
A non-issue.
Even auto lending, where there are obviously going to be problems in the subprime area, it's less than 4% of their loan exposure. It's not going to move the needle. The needle is going to be moved by what happens in cards. Student loans and autos really aren't going to move the needle.
I'm glad you bring this up, because this is I wanted to bring this up and my brain froze. I'm still getting over talking too much Yankee baseball with Doug Cass. This is what
we'll
do, folks. People go,
if
you have someone from the Cato Institute on, you have to have some leftists on to balance. That's what we're doing here, folks. We had Cass on, who loves the Yankees, and Peabody, who's got a retired number out at Fenway Park. He went to so many games as a kid. People forget that Citigroup is $70 billion in revenue, and J.P. Morgan is $100 billion in revenue, a tenth of $1 trillion. My number one complaint, Charles, is the media and so much of the public don't realize how big these things are. Are they too big to fail? Thank you, Andrew.
They definitely are too big to fail. And that too big to fail concept still exists worldwide, as we just saw with the Venetian banks in Italy. They had to be bailed out at the expense of
the
taxpayers.
Should J.P. Morgan be allowed to buy U.S. buy European banks? Why not?
I think that concentration of power would be dangerous. I think we need large banks to compete internationally, but do we need large banks in every single continent?
And they learned this the hard way. I mean, Citigroup pre-Corbett learned this in Mexico, right?
Yeah. I mean, they've struggled with their Banamex franchise, and that's one of the areas that they're trying to beef up and invest in. And there should be a payback, presumably, next year. They're actually already starting to generate some positive operating leverage in Mexico.
What's the message or the takeaway that you have from what we saw in Italy and in Spain about the way that governments intervened in those banks?
Well, as you know, there were subtle differences between what happened in Spain and Italy. But to me, it's that the rules are going to be changed to affect a process that disrupts the markets the least. And all of these, you know, regulators are looking at markets and are worried about markets and the feedback mechanism if markets go awry.
Charles Peabody, thank you so much. Congratulations on figuring out use of cash long before others here. I should point out I have no ownership of financial shares, David.
Triple leveraged cash, whatever.
I'm triple leveraged cash. I'm the double leveraged. double leveraged cash, all cash fund. It's been great talking. I mean, the markets are terrible. You can't make money in stocks, folks. What a joy and timely to have with us Daniel Yergin, who is known for oil. I just sold 6 copies of the book, The Prize, which came out, I know John D. Rockefeller read it. It came out a few years ago, and I said to some youngsters in the oil business, I said, you can't do your business unless you read Yergin, The Prize. And of course, The Quest, which I'll call an update and highly readable. Sandwiched in between it was The Commanding Heights, which is a book I throw at people too often, The Battle for the World Economy. And the royalty check I get annually from Dr. Yergin is awesome.
Yes.
On that, Dan Yergin, in honor of Lord Patton, who I spoke to today, of his Hong Kong, Mr. Yergin joining us. And I quoted to Lord Patton, Yergin, from Commanding Heights. In Hong Kong, it seemed, the particular advantages of location and the accident of history that had brought enterprise and investment to 1949. And then you go on brilliantly to say the classical liberal system in the colony compared to what was going on in the United Kingdom. I remember that years ago in your book. Give us an update on the experiment of Hong Kong. Is it working?
Well, Hong Kong stood out because it was such a vibrant center of global markets and capitalism, and its contrast to Mao's China. But of course, the world has moved on tremendously since then. Not only the rest of Asia, but China itself is such an economic powerhouse and such a center of the world economy. I was thinking just the difference between 1997, when the handover of Hong Kong occurred to China, two systems in one country, and the degree China had not yet joined the World Trade Organization. And there wasn't the sense that there was the G2, the United States and China, but now China has so much more of a preponderant role in the world economy.
Do they play with a fair deck? I mean, the President of the United States gets upset about other countries, and then maybe he's got a bit of a zero-sum architecture there. In defense of the President of the United States, is China playing with a fair capitalistic Commanding Heights deck?
No, they play with... it used to be socialism with Chinese characteristics, as Deng Xiaoping put it, and now I guess you would say it's capitalism with Chinese characteristics. It's clearly the state has a very big role in the economy, and I think it's striking to me when I've heard American CEOs talk in the last few years, they're feeling that they don't have the same access to the market as their Chinese competitors. So it is still a different system.
Hong Kong was a place to go. I wonder if you were talking to a recent graduate of your alma mater, thinking of moving overseas, would you counsel moving to Hong Kong here in the year 2017? Does it have the same sense of dynamism and opportunity that it had back then?
I think it would be one of the locations, but it would not be the standout location. I mean, going to Asia makes a lot of sense. You might say go to Shanghai, or you might say go to Beijing. I'm struck, I remember in the late 80s, too, you'd see a lot of young people went to Japan because Japan was going to be number one, if you remember the title of that book. And now, of course, you go to Beijing and you see so many young Americans, many nationalities there, and with a sense of vibrancy that is in the overall Chinese economy. and the recognition of how important China is in the global economy. The number of students who study Chinese, of course, at universities has just shot up.
Dr. Juergen, help us understand what we saw in Saudi Arabia a couple of weeks ago, the institution of a new heir apparent in the kingdom there. You know the region so well, the history and the politics of it. What should we take away from what we saw there in Riyadh a couple of weeks ago?
I think we should take away that Mohammed bin Salman, who was the deputy crown prince and promoted to crown prince, is the person who's really in charge of the country right now. He has a defense portfolio even before he moved up, the economic portfolio, the oil portfolio. And he's the author, he's the driving force behind this Vision 2030, which is seeking to sort of move the Saudi economy into you know, in a sense, what we've been talking about in Asia, into a more modern, engaged economy that isn't just based upon oil. It's a very big job to do that, and 2030 isn't so far away.
How big a, you mentioned all of the breadth of his portfolio, and we're interested in the role that oil plays in that. Of course, he's talked about moving away from the kingdom's reliance on oil. How well to pace is that transition going? How far along are we in that transformation?
I think it's still very early days, and it is interesting that, I mean, and crucial to it, I mean, the idea is to diversify the economy away from oil. In order to do that, you need oil. You need to sell a lot of oil to generate the income to do what they want to do. I think that's still very much in a phase of getting ready, trying to get things into place. And, of course, with oil at $45, it puts a lot more pressure than it would be if oil was $60 or $70, and more urgency.
What do you learn from your consultancy? What do you learn from the PhDs in petroleum, knee-deep in this and linking it into economics? What's the insight, Dr. Juergen, that you hear seminar after seminar that matters?
Well, I think if I think about the research we do at IHS Markit, I think I just came back from Detroit where we have a sort of a study group involving a number of companies and our own experts called Reinventing the Wheel, trying to understand how transportation will change, what type of vehicles people move in will change. And I think that's obviously, I find everywhere I go, that's on the minds of the global oil industry, as it is, of course, the automotive industry and the tech industry, this kind of convergence of them. I think the other big questions are the perennial questions, understanding, the overall forces of supply and demand and how the rest of the world is accommodating to this new force that has emerged out of U.S. innovation, basically, which is this shale oil and shale gas. And I was struck, as I've been traveling around the world, that in a way, other countries almost, first of all, see the change in the U.S. energy position more dramatically than we may do. And secondly, the growing recognition that the shale industry and the way it operates is a major new force in the world economy.
Let's come back and talk a bit about the shale economy. Let me ask you one question, though, about what you were just mentioning there, your trip to Detroit. Is our imagination too bridled, not unbridled, but bridled? When we think about the future of cars, we think about autonomous vehicles and driverless cars. Are you foreseeing something? When you imagine what the future of ground transportation looks like, what do you foresee happening?
Well, I think that we've learned again and again that, these kind of things, that the change can happen in ways that you don't expect and don't see. I mean, it's the 10th anniversary of the iPhone. Who imagined this whole new economy based upon
Oh, stop. You predicted that in the prize.
I was at an event last week with Prime Minister Modi from India, and he was saying how India is in a, as he put it, a digital mood, and he wants to move everybody to online banking out of the cash system. Yeah. Although after what happened in Ukraine, you may want to think twice about doing that. So I think we find that, you really do have to use kind of realistic stories about the future scenarios to try and to see what are the kind of going to be the milestones on the way to how the transportation system changes. But I think I'd say I would say that there's such a focus on this that just wasn't there 2 years ago.
I guess I want to go here, Dr. Juergen, more towards your wonderful book, The Quest. I picked it up. I was like, yeah, you know, like big deal. And it's highly readable about the new world of hydrocarbons. Dr. Juergen, where are the big oil companies in 10 or 20 years? They're not dinosaurs, but what are they?
I think they will become, first of all, more gas companies, more focused on natural gas. Secondly, I think you see the big companies hung back from shale. They left it to the independents, and I think they now see that shale needs to be part of their portfolios because of the flexibility it gives them to sort of flex their systems up and down as the markets change. But I think they're all going, I think back to our CERAWeek conference a couple months ago, I think they're all going through a sort of soul-searching about, you know, what kind of energy transition is at hand and what their role in it will be. So I think, you know, they'll still be there. There'll be large players. World demand still, I think, over the next 10 or 20 years will continue to grow, but they are kind of looking at how much do they need to move into being other parts of the sort of value chain in energy.
Are we looking?
And I'd say that other big thing is gas, really. They, you know, they start to refer themselves as gas and oil companies rather than oil and gas companies.
As we look here at oil in the mid to high 40s, I wonder if you think we're facing more bankruptcies, not at the major oil corporations, of course, but in the industry as a whole.
I think that we, you know, over 100 companies went bankrupt after the 2014, when prices really started down. Their assets remained there, just the companies went through reorganizations in some form. I think that the companies have generally re-engineered themselves to operate at a much lower cost level. When the prices started to collapse at the end of 2014, the assumption among many was that at $70 these companies disappear. They've now re-engineered themselves to work at $40 to $50 a barrel. So I think there's a much greater resilience there in the system. Obviously, the closer you get to 40, the more pressure it creates on these companies. But I think, and what we see, we just did an analysis, look at the whole cost structure of the industry. Around the world, you see this kind of re-engineering to operate more in a kind of $50 mm-hmm. world. And looking back at $100, it was a few years ago, it was seen as a new normal. Yeah. Now it's seen as an aberration.
I want to rip up the script, Dr. Juergen, which we can always do for you. You and I are at Davos. What people don't know is there's a valley as we look out to the right side of our TV set. And there's a glacier there that's, I think in 5 or 10 years, Dr. Juergen, the glacier will be on our set, the way it's coming down the mountain. There's a glacier or iceberg in Antarctica right now that's the size of Delaware or something. It's going to break off and nobody knows what's going to happen to it. Give us an update on your thoughts on climate change and your thoughts on the calculus of climate change, the rates of change of climate change.
Well, I'm not a, first thing I have to say is I'm not a client scientist, so.
But you read it and everybody knows you. Come on.
Right. So I think that, you know, the recognition is that, you know, the climate is changing. There's a wide spectrum of alarm at how fast it's going to change.
Yeah.
And it's, I think you see, if you look at the oil industry, you see a number of the major companies now in favor of a carbon tax to kind of give a kind of predictability to future investments.
Within that, in the auction process and how it hasn't worked in Europe, and that is the rate of change of all this. Is this all happening faster than we thought?
Is what? Is climate change happening
yes.
faster than we thought?
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, it's been so heavily studied that I don't know if you can say that the pace is faster than we thought. I mean, you know, clearly the carbon levels are up higher and we're much more conscious of change. I saw that Chancellor Merkel just today reinforced that all the European countries remain committed to the Paris Agreement. I think the other aspect of it is that, the energy base is changing. There is a growing role of renewables. Wind and solar now are 8% of our electricity.
Does it change the incentive system for going to renewable energy? That is, if you have an administration that isn't backing it to the degree the previous one was, does that change what companies are investing in?
Well, I think that the in the U.S., I mean, obviously the real focus was on Paris and whether we were in or out, and with all the repercussions that people have on different sides of it. But, of course, Paris did not commit countries to specific things. It was that they said they'd do these things. To me, what stands out is, two things. One, Trump administration, he said that he was going to back out of Paris, and so in a way it shouldn't be a surprise that that he took the U.S. out of it or seeks to take the U.S. out because it's a long process. Mm-hmm. But I think what's really significant is the tax incentives that were put in at the end of 2015, and we think that as a result of those, two-thirds of the new electric capacity will be wind and solar.
Okay.
And that's a change, and that's going to happen.
Right.
Whatever.
We have to leave it there. Dan Juergen, thank you so much. Never enough time with Dr. Juergen. Read The Quest. This is Bloomberg. David Gura, I am in such shock I can't speak. It is so unique in the history of the nation to have a chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee actually show up on time for a radio interview. I believe that's a first. It goes back at least to Madison and maybe as far as Washington.
And we thank the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. That is one Kevin Brady, the congressman from the 8th District in Texas. That's Montgomery County, Walker County, just north of Houston, if I'm not mistaken. Joining us on our phone line this morning. There's no more important person to talk to on the issue of tax reform in particular than Congressman Brady. Great to have you with us this morning.
Well, thank you for that intro. I'm not sure I can talk. The Madison reference, so I'll take it.
We'll see where we go. Let me ask you first. Let me first ask you about the calendar here. Congress approaching the July 4th recess. You guys come back. You've got about 10 legislative working days, if I'm not mistaken, and then it's onward to the August recess. How worried are you at this point about the compressed congressional calendar?
Look, I'm not. We know what the schedule is. I'm confident, frankly. The Senate is going to resolve their differences and deliver on health care reform. I know our challenge in the House going forward is to finish this budget and move that to the Senate because that budget's really key to tax reform this fall. And so, look, it is a tight schedule. I think we can meet it.
Let me ask you a question here about where things are headed when it comes to tax reform. I wonder if you'd be open to an overhaul that would include maybe temporary cuts on the individual side, but permanent changes for those on the corporate side. Are you willing to weigh that or consider that at this point in light of where we are?
So right now I'm focused on bold, permanent tax reform that dramatically simplifies the code, really lowers rates significantly for job creators and middle-class families, but as importantly, leapfrogs America from, I think, roughly 31st in the world into the top three for competitiveness. We're focused on that permanence because we think that's critical for companies making the investment decisions. They create jobs for families.
Congressman Robert Kaplan of the Dallas Fed of the People's Republic of Texas just told me that all of this uncertainty in the land of Brady is going to dampen economic growth. Is the uncertainty of your Washington going to dampen or slow economic growth in Texas?
Well, no, I don't believe it will. In fact, back home, where I spent a lot of time, we live back in the Woodlands, just northeast, and where people are families and small businesses especially, they're very excited about tax reform. They feel like we're going to get it done. It makes them more optimistic about this year and next going forward. And so I think in the world of politics and anguishing over every different phrase and word, you know, there's uncertainty. But I think businesses large and small feel confident we're going to get this done.
I listened with interest a couple of weeks back when the House Speaker Paul Ryan spoke before the National Association of Manufacturers in Washington, D.C., and the news, so much as I could ascertain what it was, is that he placed a deadline on getting this done. He said, let's get tax reform done here by the end of the year. I was struck by the urgency in that statement. Is your sense of urgency, is his, being matched by the White House? Would you like to see the White House doing more to make this the paramount issue for him?
So it is. In my experience with President Trump's tax team, that urgency is clearly there. They know where the economy is struggling. They know we're falling behind. 2017 is the timetable we've set. I haven't seen anything yet that knocks us off that timetable, and I don't anticipate one. So I share that urgency, and I believe the White House does as well.
You know, David, I want you to continue here with the chairman, but I want to make clear, folks, we need a surveillance correction. Chairman Brady talks about the Woodlands, and it sounds like he lives in a pup tent outside Houston. I just want to point out to everybody that you can get for $545,000, five bedrooms, three plus baths. David, this thing is the size of Brooklyn. I mean, it's these houses are ginormous. Where Chairman Brady lives, and frankly, that's part of the competition that Texas wins at. You can almost afford the stuff.
You can't talk about real estate outside of Brooklyn with somebody in Brooklyn. Yeah,
affordable housing is one of our strengths in Texas, and with low taxes, no income tax.
You're killing me. We're blessed. We're moving the show to Texas. Let's go,
Chairman Brady. Let's talk a bit about the conversations you're having with the White House about the border-adjusted tax. You've embraced that. It's a central part of the plan that you've devised with the House Speaker. You've floated the idea of a five-year phase-in for a border-adjusted tax. What's the case you're making to the White House now? Get us up to speed on where things stand when it comes to the conversation over a BAT.
Yeah, so here's one of the we have several big challenges in tax reform, and one of them is how do we stop businesses from continuing to leave the U.S.? More importantly, how do we get them to reconsider their supply chains to determine what can be brought back to the United States? Because our current tax code clearly tells them move it elsewhere. And so our proposal on border adjustment matches our competitors. Basically, it's equal taxation in the U.S., and by lifting the Made in America tax, a level playing field abroad. It is a bold change, and I recognize that. And that's why the five-year phase-in is proposed to address what we believe are valid concerns about making sure there's plenty of time for the dollar to adjust and all of that. But bottom line is, whether border adjustment is in the final product or it is set aside for further study, the problem still persists. How do we stop companies from leaving? How do we bring them back? And so we're having a really good discussion with the White House and Senate on how best to solve that issue. And I'm just telling you, we're going to stay at the table with President Trump's team and Senate Republicans till we solve that principal issue.
Right. Chairman Brady, I got one more serious question for you before you get on with your productive day. You more than anybody we speak to knows the upset of parents and families broken apart and by violence and that. I've begun calling the opioid epidemic the heroin opioid epidemic because I don't think anybody listening in the real world knows what opioids are. You're in a leadership position. What does Washington need to do to help Woodlands, Texas, a rich place, or the poor place you know better than me in Houston? What does Washington need to do about the heroin opioid epidemic?
Well, it is an epidemic, and we've seen we've worked to close down pill mills in Southeast Texas, and there's 1,400 of them in the Houston region, all of which drive that epidemic. It's going to take several concerted efforts, and one of them, frankly, is in healthcare. I was pleased to see the Senate add some more funding to address this in the health care bill that they have. The House has already, and Senate has acted in some other ways as well. But what I'm actually really pleased about is this has finally gotten the attention it deserves, both up here in Washington and back home as well. And so this issue isn't going to go away, and we know we've got to act.
Chairman, thank you so much. David, why don't you exit the chairman out here as gracefully as you always do.
Chairman Kevin Brady there, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee from the 8th District in Texas.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated.